Welcome to Wine for Normal People, the podcast for people who like wine, but not the snobbery that goes with it. I'm your host, Elizabeth Schneider, author of the Wine for Normal People book and certified wine dork. This podcast is sponsored by Wine Access. Go to wineaccess.com/normal and join the Wine Access Wine for Normal People Wine Club. $150, 6 bottles, 4 times a year. I pick them out. Get on it today, wineaccess.com/normal. And if you want to shop and see what they have, sample the goods, go to wineaccess.com/WFMP so they know that you found them through me. Get 10% off your first order. And now let's get to the show. I hope that you all listened to the announcement this week that MC Ice, unfortunately, is no longer going to be on the show. So you have me as your guide to wine. I'm still going to be here every week. Sometimes I'll have guests. Sometimes I'll have some patrons joining me as guest hosts. A lot of times I'm just going to do the show alone. I teach so many classes and do all this stuff, public speaking. I think that it's going to be okay. We will still have fun, even if it's just you and me together. We will still have a good walk or commute or whatever you're doing while you're listening to this. Okay, we had that. And then the second part of the announcement was the back catalog is on Patreon. It is now a perk to the members. So if you want to get access to that, you got to go to patreon.com/wineforNormalPeople. You'll get a special link. It'll give you access as long as you remain a patron. You can listen to the back episodes of the show. I want to do a bunch of patron shout outs because I have had guests on. There's been some chaos, some changes, blah, blah, blah. And I owe our dear patrons who help keep this podcast going, who are part of this community, has been so supportive during this change. That's another thing. You get previews of all of these announcements that I make elsewhere. As a patron, you're going to get that first. They've been really helpful in the change over into some of the new things that have happened, including getting all the technology going. Thank you, patrons, for putting up with me while we were moving the technology over to get you your private feeds. Let me give the shout outs and then we will get started. And I will tell you about why I am so freaking excited about this week's podcast and some of the other ones that are coming up. We will thank Louis C., Kimber J., Robert S., Volins, Jamie Lynn L., Julian G., Gabriel T., Mackenzie and Brendan, Pamela F., Kurt A., Drew B., William W., Daisy C. Daisy, I'm excited to have that drink with you in Madrid. Tesh, Carlos, Thomas H., T., Maddie, Rose C., Julia W., Enrique A., Daniel S., Kristen G., Grant, Mariana, Edward J., Donna, Sunday, Elizabeth S., David M., Rich S., Layton, Stephen S., and Henry F. I will get the rest of you next time. I promise. Now I'm only a month behind. So bad. I'm so sorry. But I promise I will get to you because we always need to be grateful. Attitude of gratitude, everybody. We shout out the patrons because we should all be grateful to them for helping us keep the show alive. And for those of us in the community, for just being cool people that are part of this awesome group. The show. I want to talk about why I am so excited about this and a couple of the other shows that are coming up. Now, I have started research for the second book. Yay! In the midst of a bunch of transition, I still am really determined and now am really excited. I was telling a friend of mine, like, I felt like my chi was blocked for a while. I was like, I really want to write this book, but I'm just feeling like I don't have the flow. All of a sudden, I just feel like I'm ready to go. So I am starting research on the book. Now, the book is going to be based on the series that we've done for a couple years now, The Greats. And some of the greats are going to be regions. For instance, the first greats that we did was Châteauneuf du Pape. So for that, the whites and the reds are very famous. So it will be all of Châteauneuf du Pape. It will be both the reds and the whites that I'll discuss. But then there are some places where just one grape is the star. In this particular case, I started doing research on Australia. And one of the things that I did, I'm starting to dig into primary sources. I'm reading things from the 1800s. I'm reading all sorts of logs. So freaking dorky. But Hunter Valley is the first place in Australia that I'm really tackling. And the reason is because it is the first place where Australian grape growing took place. The number of famous wineries on the rolling hills and valleys in the Hunter Valley is incredible. It's like name after name after name of famous Australian producers. the Hunter Valley is a huge tourist destination because it's only 2 hours. It's about 160 kilometers or 100 miles north of Sydney. It is in New South Wales. So you've got the wine region, and then you have UNESCO World Heritage National Parks bordering. So it is an incredibly appealing place to visit. Now, from a wine perspective, it's pretty fascinating. Now, we did have Connie from Tranquil Vale come on and talk about the Hunter Valley. She's fantastic, but we've never done a show to really dig into it. So I'm going to get more into this, but just as an overview, I mean, we're talking about a place that's pretty low latitude. And if you have a place that is low latitude, 32 degrees south, you're going to have mitigating factors. Otherwise, viticulture is not going to work because the sun is so strong. So if we think about Santa Barbara being in the 30s, if we think about places in Chile being in the 30s in south latitude, what you find in this case, or in all of these cases, is that there's got to be a Pacific breeze or the Humboldt Current, or you have to have elevation or something. In this case, we're going to have some other mitigating factors in the better parts of the Hunter Valley. The other thing about the Hunter Valley, which is so interesting, is that even though it's such a popular tourist destination, it's pretty well known, it's only 2,605 hectares or 6,437 acres of vineyard. This is 2% of Australian vineyards. But because it is really hard to farm, as we talk about the climate and the land, you'll understand why I'm saying this. You really have quality, premium wines. You don't have bulk. This is not Riverland or Riverina or some of the places where it's a little bit easier to grow grapes. It's much, much smaller, much lower yields. Also, it's about a quarter of the national average. Another curiosity is that 47% of what they grow is red and 53% is white, which means that it's mainly a white wine region. In all of Australia, 64% of what is grown is red. So the fact that it's almost a 50-50 split, but also is leaning towards white is very unusual. Again, it has to do with some of the heritage and the history. The thing that I want to say here is that I will talk about some of the other grapes because I think it's interesting. It's important for you to know what else they grow. And of course, they would argue that their Chardonnay and Shiraz are as good as the Semillon. But Semillon is the crown jewel. And I will explain why, but we've talked about it before on the show. Semillon does something in the Hunter Valley that no one can even really explain why it does what it does. It's some combination of the land, the winemaking, and the alchemy. It is a very unusual wine. And again, this is one of the greats. 25% of plantings, Semillon. Chardonnay is 30% of plantings. And then you have Shiraz at 24%. And then interestingly, Verdelho, which is a grape that is actually used in Madeira in Portugal, is about 12% of plantings. That's really their everyday, light, breezy, fruity wine. The others are relatively serious. Let's talk about the history. The Hunter Valley was discovered, I put it in quotation marks, because actually this was an ancient land. The Wanarua people, it's a group of indigenous Australians. They were inhabitants and occupied the upper Hunter Valley for at least 30,000 years before they got driven out by the settlers around 1797. They were looking for escaped convicts because, if you remember, Australia was a penal colony and there were a lot of convicts, and the convicts definitely outnumbered the people who were supposed to be managing them, so they often escaped. And in looking for escaped convicts, one of the people in charge found the Hunter Valley. Let's talk about the 200 years of wine growing and wine making. Started in about 1823, you had really small plots of land, 20 acres, 8 hectares in 1823, and then it started to expand. And part of the expansion was, there were a couple of people that were very important in that. One of them is George Wyndham, who was one of the founding fathers of the Australian wine industry. He established his winery that was on the banks of the Hunter River. It was called Dalwood. That was in 1830, so that was one of the first. James King at Irrawang was another one. And then the really famous person here was James Busby. James Busby was a young guy. He came with his family. His father had a magistrate position or something like that in Sydney. The whole family came to live in Australia. shortly after James went back to the UK. And he had a fascination, even in his 20s, with viticulture. He had written several books. He decided to go throughout France and Spain and get vine clippings from the best vineyards in the world. He did this on his own dime, and then he came back and said to the colonial authority of Australia, listen, I have all of these grapevines, but I can't afford to ship them to Australia, but I think this would be very, very important. So they actually agreed to do that. He actually picked up some more plant matter in South Africa. And in 1832, he arrived with these vine cuttings. And most of them went to the Sydney Botanical Gardens, who wound up just screwing it up and ruining and killing them. But a bunch of them went to growers who were in the Hunter Valley. And one of those growers was his brother-in-law, William Kelman, and his sister, Catherine. They took advantage of a land grant in the Hunter Valley. So the way it worked is basically if you're a rich person, they allowed you to have some land and you had to cultivate it and sort of keep the settlement going. So it was at Kirkton on the Hunter River. That was the name. And that was with James Busby's vines. After these three kind of founders, James King, George Wyndham, and James Busby, or the Kelman family, started guiding things. They created a vintner society, all of this kind of stuff. You had other people like Dr. Henry Lindeman. It's kind of sad that Lindeman is like bottom shelf wine for $5 now, because he was one of the second wave of really important people. I love that he was a doctor. There's so much history of doctors coming in and making wine. I'm thinking of all of the patrons and people that I know who listen to the show who are fascinated with wine. There's a real affinity there. I'll have to dig into that at another time. But there were other families also, Drayton family, the Tulloch family, the Turrells, the Wilkinsons. So together they helped establish vineyards in the region in the mid to late 1800s. Now, Morris O'Shea was another person that was very pivotal. He was a young vintner. He convinced his mother to buy a property at Mount Pleasant, this winery in the Hunter Valley in the Pocalbin area. Bought that in 1921. It was much later than that first group, of course. But Morris O'Shea was a real pioneer and incredibly important because he specialized in blending grapes. So he didn't have any worry about, well, you can't blend Pinot and Cabernet, or you can't. He blended things according to what he thought tasted good. And this really goes to the tradition of Australians still doing that today with their Cab Shiraz blends. Sometimes you'll see some interesting blends of various other grapes together, Chardonnay and Semillon sometimes. He also was adamant that the wine should be dry. Now, at the time, Australia was only really doing fortified wine. So this was a real revolutionary thing. And because his wines were really good, people started to follow him. But the Hunter Valley really bucked the trend of the sweet fortified wines, whereas everybody else was making them. They were making dry wines under Morris O'Shea. He also, and this is super important, loved Semillon as a single varietal wine, which was incredibly uncommon. Now, I just said he was known for blending, but in 1946, he planted the Lovedale Vineyard at Mount Pleasant. And this is still to this day a productive Semillon vineyard and completely famous. By 1930, the Hunter Valley had a reputation for high quality, dry table wines. Now, unfortunately, even though I said in 1946, the Lovedale Vineyard was planted, there were a lot of ups and downs, just like in the rest of the world. From the 30s to the 60s, you had depression, you had the world wars, you had recovery, and it just took a really long time. It wasn't until 1960, Penfolds in the upper Hunter Valley bought a huge vineyard. And then in 1963, you see some reestablishment of the area. Lake's Folly Vineyard was the first new commercial vineyard that was planted in the 20th century. And then we started to see a renaissance in the 70s and 80s, especially with Shiraz and with Chardonnay. And today we are seeing more changes again in the Hunter Valley, but a handful of Hunter Valley estates still make wine from 11 historic blocks of the original plantings that are on native European rootstocks that came over with either James Busby or with the initial plantings. It's crazy. So we have Shiraz, Semillon, and Chardonnay, Drayton, Mount Pleasant, Pools Rock, and Terrells own those 11 historic blocks. Actually, six of the 11 are owned by Terrells. Today, there's 150 wineries in the Hunter Valley, and small production, lots of innovation, lots of experimentation by small producers. But the thing I'm going to emphasize again is, as we talk about the greats, yes, there's good Chardonnay, there's good Shiraz, but the true great of this region is Semillon. It is really important to know this. Jancis Robinson refers to the Semillon as Australia's gift to the world. And it is true. It is true because it is a curiosity and it is something really special. All right, let's talk about the climate and some of the vineyard stuff, and then we'll talk about the Semillon itself. I feel like I'm building up to this. So the climate here, I already said 32 degrees south latitude. It's subtropical and it has a marine influence. Warm, humid days in the spring and summer, cold nights in the fall and the winter. It's warm and it's wet and humid. It's one of the warmest wine regions in Australia. It can rain during harvest in some years and during the summer growing season. So it is really hard to manage. Rot and mildew can be a problem. They do have vintage variation. They also don't have a lot of diurnal swings. It's a fairly moderated temperature. They have hail sometimes. What is the mitigating factor in the climate? They are cooled by regular cloud cover that forms every afternoon. And that's going to cool down the grapes and cover the sun up and make sure these grapes don't get sunburned. And then they also have these soft sea breezes from the Pacific that are going to reach inland to many areas, not all, just so you know, not all areas are being reached by that Pacific coastal breeze. That can temper very high temperatures. Usually those are the higher quality vineyards, those that are benefiting both from the cloud cover and from the breeze. This is not an ideal situation climate-wise for any world-class wines, but somehow the soils and the climate and the know-how somehow produce a lot of flavor in Semillon. They harvest a lot earlier than other regions because it is so warm, there's so much sun. It's going to be a real important thing for them to get those grapes off the vines before their sunburn and also so that they can still have balance. We will take a step away from the podcast to thank our sponsors this week. I talked about it at the beginning, but Wine Access and I have come up with some pretty amazing stuff this year for the wine club. So if you are thinking that you want to start trying some new wines that either I talk about in the show or just things that normally you wouldn't have access to, Wine Access, or things that maybe are very classic examples of wines, so you can kind of get your finger on what things should taste like or what typical examples are, there is nothing better than this wine club. It is six bottles, four times a year for $150, shipping's included. You get videos that I make, you get a letter that I write, you get all of Wine Access's amazing wine notes about the winery and about pairings and serving temperatures. So well thought out. It is just hitting the easy button, and it is a great way to get fantastic wines, especially as we're moving into the summer and you might be doing a little more entertaining. It's a great time to join the wine club. So think about it. Wine Access, wineaccess.com/normal is how you'll do the wine club. And then if you're interested in just shopping on the site, grabbing one or two bottles, go to wineaccess.com/WFMP. You'll see a page of wines that I absolutely love. It's your gateway into the site. That'll let them know that you found them through me. We are so grateful to them. They enable the last year of shows to be free to everybody. They are awesome. So please support them as they support the show. They are awesome. What a great partner. And really think about joining that wine club. I'm telling you, you will be hooked once you get your first shipment. Wineaccess.com/normal and wineaccess.com/WFNP. Get 10% off your first order. Do it today. Also, if you would like access to the back catalog of Wine for Normal People and would like to join an amazing community of supportive, funny, cool, wine-loving normal people, go to patreon.com slash Wine for Normal People, and that will give you access in the welcome note that you receive. You will learn how to get access to the back catalog, and as long as you continue to be a patron, you will have access to the catalog. Also, you get access to this amazing community. We have so much great stuff going on, mini classes, hangouts, lots of great conversation every week. Check it out. Even if you're just going to join because you think you only want access to the back catalog, check out the page. See how much content is on there. I have been on Patreon since 2018. There are things on there that you will never see anywhere else. You can only access them if you're a patron. So patreon.com/wineforNormalPeople. And now let's get back to this show, which I think you can probably tell I'm very into this. I'm just loving the research for the book. I'm dorking out about all of this stuff. Let's get back to the show. Because of the warmth and the humidity and the strong sun and the heavy rains and the summer storms, you have to be really skilled to farm here. It's partially why it's so small. It's partially why you really have to have very dedicated winemakers here. They have to do things like canopy management. So you have to shade the bunches so that you don't inhibit the airflow around the vines, but at the same time, you protect them from the strong sun. Trellising, you have to pick the trellising system, the rootstocks, row spacing, all of that is going to make a huge difference in whether or not your grapes are burned or heavy or too alcoholic. So it is really a game of making sure that that's happening. The other thing is you got to reduce vigor. Irrigation management is important. Many of them do not irrigate, actually, but you have to make sure that you don't irrigate too much. You have to do pruning. You have to do shoot and bunch thinning and leaf removal and position the shoots. You need a very skilled vineyard crew if you are going to work in the Hunter Valley, because you have to make sure there's enough airflow to dry off from the humidity, from the rain. But you also then have to make sure there's enough leaf cover to protect the vines from sun. It's almost an impossible task. The soil and the land. Okay, so the Hunter is in the foothills of the Broken Back Range, not Broke Back, Broken Back Range, part of the Great Dividing Range. And this is where those national parks are. This is going to be a little bit confusing. I'll talk about the subregions, but it includes the region of Hunter. And then there are subregions, Upper Hunter Valley, Broke Forbach, and Pocolbin. So the Hunter River is in the northern parts of the valley. And you have a lot of, again, because it rains a lot, you have a lot of these green hills, and the soils are very varied. But because it sits on an ancient seabed, and over time, those layered deposits have become rock and shale and form this very diverse terrain. There's also some volcanic areas that are making some really good wines near the hills of the Broken Back Range. Less vigor, a really good flavor. But the Lower Hunter Valley is where you're going to see most of the wines. And the Lower Hunter Valley has two terrains. It has alluvial, sandy flatlands. Semillon loves this kind of soil. And then it has red loam on top of clay. And this is great for Shiraz. These soils that have some contrasting texture, maybe there's sand or loam on top of clay, that's what Shiraz does well. But Semillon does well on these sandy alluvial flatlands. So within the Hunter Valley, it was always unofficially delimited between the Lower Hunter and the Upper Hunter. They have very similar climate and land. But in 2010, they made an official designation. There is now the Upper Hunter Valley geographical indication. So they have geographical indications. That's what we have. And then we have kind of sub or local geographical indications. The Hunter Valley geographical indication. This is really confusing. Hunter Valley is different from Hunter geographical indication. They cover almost the same area, but the Hunter GI was set up in 1997 to take out the area that included the national parks. Newcastle is the big city here. It takes out that metro area, took out the land on the coastline that wasn't making any sense because you're not going to grow grapes there. So it's all about the vineyard focus. So the Hunter area is smaller, and within it, there are other local GIs. The Lower Hunter Valley is not actually an officially defined region, but it includes Pocolbin, It includes some other areas, Mount View and Lovedale and districts around there. Pacolban GI, geographical indication, was created in 2010. This was when they broke out the Upper Hunter Valley GI. They also granted these sub-GIs. This is the heart of the Lower Hunter Valley, really where so many wineries are. Most of the history of the Hunter Valley takes place in Pacolban. And this is one of Australia's most northerly vineyard areas. It is hot. This covers the vineyards along the Hunter River, just west of the city of Newcastle. Some of the first vineyards in Australia were planted in Pacolban. The first Semillon was actually planted in Pacolban. The summer heat is mitigated by the ranges, which are going to produce that cloud cover, draw in cooling afternoon sea breezes. Pacolban is very famous. Tyrrells produced the first Australian Chardonnay here. It's the site of a lot of the earliest Australian vine plantings. Then you have the Broke Fordich geographical indication. This is also in the Lower Hunter area. It's between the Upper Hunter Valley subregion, which is in the northwest, and Pacolban is in the east. It's much smaller. It has red volcanic soils around the town of Broke and the town of Fordich, which is why it's called Broke Fordich GI. It's one of the warmest areas in the Lower Hunter. It's more continental almost, and it is protected from the sea breezes by the foothills of the Broken Back Range, which means it is going to have much more intensely flavored fruit. The Upper Hunter Valley GI is kind of farther inland. It's even warmer. It doesn't have any sea breezes. It has black, silty soils, and it is relatively small and pretty hot. Before I get to the Semillon, which is our main event, I just want to mention Shiraz. Shiraz has been grown in the Hunter Valley since the first vines were planted. Some of the oldest Shiraz vines in Australia are planted in the Hunter Valley. They used to be huge wines. They followed the trends. These wines were enormous. They were really high in alcohol. They had huge fruit. They were bursting with plum flavor, tons of oak. One of the criticisms of the old school, the old style Shiraz from the Hunter Valley, was that it smelled and tasted like sweaty saddle. Now, anybody that's ever ridden a horse knows what that is like. It's like this kind of old leather horse sweat kind of thing. It really was not great, and it was very strong. I remember tasting it. Unless you've smelled that smell before, it's really hard to describe it, but it's kind of gross. It had potential, but it was just, they were picking it so late, putting so much oak on it. Now it's much more subtle. It's more like red and dark berries and plums. Now they still do an oak treatment, but they're going for a more savory, lighter style with more earth notes that are going to develop over time. So they're picking earlier. They're looking for wines that can age for a couple decades. I think it's part of the Hunter culture to continuously reevaluate and to do better. And their oldest vineyards are from 1867 of Shiraz. So Chardonnay is another of the big grapes. This is the most planted. One of the first regions to grow Chardonnay was the Hunter. It's completely overshadowed by the Semillon because the Semillon is so famous. But the Chardonnay here is peachy with citrus. And then if they do put oak on it, it's got vanilla flavors and caramel flavors, good acidity usually. Tyrrells created the Australian benchmark style for Chardonnay. Oaky, buttery, huge fruit, higher alcohol. That was VAT 47 Chardonnay. Today, you have much more subtle oak. They're going for something leaner, something more like green apple and citrus rather than big peachy fruit and tons of oak. There is still oak on the Chardonnay, but it's not as big. And then I mentioned Verdelho before because that is 12% of plantings. They're also trying tons of new things with the climate changing. Reds like Tempranillo and Sangiovese and Torriga Nacional and Barbera. And whites, Vermentino and Fiano, they really like the Italians. So lots of new things coming out of the Hunter Valley. If you go there, expect to see all sorts of different grapes being grown. But the great here is Semillon. Semillon, first planted in the 1830s. Today, the oldest vineyards are from 1899. It was a preferred grape because it can be vigorous. It's easy to propagate, at least here it was. And it has, well, if you don't control it, it can have high yields. It is resistant to disease. It was a good grape to grow, so people really liked it. Early on, since nobody knows what the hell Semillon is, they labeled it as Hunter River Riesling, or even worse, Rhine Riesling. They called it Hock, which was the British name for German Riesling, White Burgundy, or Chablis. They were trying to get the style profile. Basically, what they were trying to convey is that here is a wine that has high acidity and nice fruit flavor. It's just so wrong. I can't even. I mean, at least they stopped doing that. Unlike in the US, we still see at the bottom in the jug wines, we still see Chablis and Hardy Burgundy and all that kind of stuff. So ridiculous. But anyway, don't get me started. But it is widely agreed on that Hunter Valley Semillon are completely unique. And it is because these Semillon get different characteristics, unique characteristics as they age. They can age 20 years or more. They are made incredibly simply. They grow the grapes in those alluvial, dried up, sandy riverbeds. They pick the grapes very early. The alcohol is low. They're not getting to high sugar levels. They're only achieving 10 to 12% alcohol. High acidity, ripe flavors, as I mentioned before. Even when it's picked early, you still have flavor. No oak, no malolactic fermentation. There is usually some lees aging, which is where you're going to get the toastiness later on. Although a lot of times toastiness from lees aging shows up a lot sooner than it does in these Semillons. And then after that, they're bottled very quickly. So you get a couple of months of lees aging, and then you bottle these wines. If you have a current vintage Semillon, you will see the following things. Basically colorless. They call it water white. You will get some citrus, grassiness. It might be a little bit like hay or green herbs, green apple. You might get a little bit of mineraliness, but mostly it's going to be kind of harsh and acid, different from what you'll get in a Bordeaux version. Bordeaux usually has Sauvignon Blanc blended in and Muscadel sometimes. Bordeaux, you're going to have maybe lower acidity. The wines are going to be softer and waxier. They'll be more drinkable early on. This is what happens to Hunter Valley Semillon. After about 5 years, and you can try this yourself, get a Semillon from the Hunter Valley. And in year 5 or 6, this transformation starts to happen and then it just continues. It turns a dark color. And then it starts taking on flavors like grilled nuts and other kinds of roasted nuts. It gets honeyed. It tastes like honeysuckle and it's toasty. Now, I just want to remind you, no malolactic fermentation and no oak aging. Still, you're getting like lemon curd creaminess, luscious, creamy, soft textures. That is not what I just described as the young wine. With time, now it seems like it's a well-made oaky Chardonnay, but it has not been an oak. It has not had malolactic fermentation. It's a living wine. This is probably the best proof point for how wine can be radically transformed with time in the bottle. Now, most wines are relatively recognizable from point A to point B, but in this case, if you have a young Semillon, after 5 years or 8 years or 10 years, you can have something so completely different that it really just shows how fascinating wine is. The best examples, the ones that are very high quality, are still after 15 years, after 10 years, are going to have this primary fruit, great acidity and citrus notes, even after they've spent a ton of time in the cellar. So that is the alchemy. And again, people have tried to figure out why it is that growing in this area, which really isn't very well suited to wine at all, really, but certainly not a grape like Semillon, growing on alluvial flat riverbeds, picked early, made very simply, how can you take this wine and you taste it and it's fine to start out with, but the real magic of this wine is just letting it sit and watching it. You can see the color start to change with time. You just leave it in your cellar. Unfortunately, they do keep it in clear bottles. Not all of them do, but some of them do. So this is why Jancis Robinson calls it Australia's gift to the world, because it is so different. There's nothing that you could compare it to. There's no other wine that does that. It really is one of the greatest wines. Now, they are also making the Semillon in other styles, but the real great is this dry style. They do make some off-dry styles. There's some producers that are making sparkling Semillon. The aged Hunter Valley Semillon is really what we're looking at. If you do have a young Semillon, you want to have that with scallops or shrimp, light fish dishes, oysters. An aged Hunter Valley Semillon, you're going to have with herbal preparations, cream sauces, soft cheeses, that will be better with an aged Semillon. And remember that if it's very old and you really want to enjoy it, just have it with cheese because you want the wine to shine. Some famous wines. Sadly, we can't get most of them in the US, but if you are in the UK or Australia, you certainly can look for this. And there are some wines from the same producers. They're just not from the top vineyards. Brokenwood Wines, ILR Reserve Semillon. That's about $50 US if you can get your hands on it. Mount Pleasant Elizabeth, love it, Semillon from the Lovedale Vineyard. That has been awarded multiple times. Can't get that in the US, sadly. Tyrrell's Vat 1 Semillon, very old vineyard, considered the highest level of Semillon in the world, $85 if you can get it. Also, Jono's Semillon from Tyrrell's was planted in 1908. There are 2 hectares or 5.1 acres of Semillon still planted there from that 1908 planting, so over 110 years old. Andrew Thomas Braemar Vineyards, that's about $50 US if you can get it. Again, most of these wines are only going to be available in Australia and in the UK, some in Canada as well, but we don't see them that much in the US. That being said, you will be able to get a Tyrrell's Semillon from the Hunter Valley. You will be able to get a Brokenwood Semillon. You will be able to get other things. It just won't be these top tier wines. Still, after 5 years, they're going to taste great. As I'm sort of reflecting on this, I mean, I look for Hunter Valley Semillon frequently so that I can age a bottle, but it is hard to find, at least the higher end, the higher tier ones that I would really want to lay down. It's of a shame because the US really fell in love with the big Chardonnays and the big Shiraz and the big Cabs from Australia, and that was really all that was marketed. So we never got to see one of the greatest wines that Australia has to offer, but that does not mean that we can't get access to great Hunter Valley Semillon. We absolutely can do that. I would recommend that everybody try to get a bottle of this. Have a bottle of aged Australian Semillon or age a bottle of Australian Semillon. The rewards after 5 years are going to be really special. You definitely owe it to yourself to try this wine, to see it, because it is, in fact, one of the great wines of the world. If you look at the history and the legacy, it is Australian history in a bottle, and then it is Australian alchemy that we really don't understand in the bottle as well. And it is a living wine and proves that wine has an evolution. It can do things on its own that we have an intention, and then it gets even better. So it is really a magical thing. I think what's very important is in this series, that if you did not know that one of these wines was considered one of the greatest wines in the world, now you know. Some regions, it's very obvious that they're famous, but it's not always obvious why they're famous. As I do more research and I bring you more of these gems from the book that I am researching, I think the why behind it, the fact that, again, this was part of some of the first clippings, that it has a history, that it's one of the first dry wines of Australia, one of the first varietal dry wines of Australia, that it's in this very special region. All of these things make a huge difference to making this wine one of the greats. I hope that you enjoyed this. One of my first solo episodes, I've done this before, but one of my first solo episodes. And with that, this has been another episode of Wine for Normal People. Thank you so much for listening, and we will catch you next time.